So welcome to the second part of our Zen Owning Trilogy. My name is Joanna Rutkowska, this is Rafał Wojciuk. We work for Invisible Things Lab. Well, ironically, this title sounds most defensive out of our three speeches. Interestingly, it will be actually the most offensive speech. So previously on Zen Owning Trilogy, so this is a quick summary of Rafał's talk. He presented DMA attacks against Zen using both TG3 card, network card, the manual attack, and also using a disk controller, very generic DMA attack. He also implemented Zen loadable modules, something similar to Linux kernel modules. This is in quotation mark because obviously sounds funny because Zen is not supposed to be extendable, of course. But we have this framework and can load arbitrary code there. And going further, he implemented two different backdoors, a hypervisor rootkits, different from virtualization-based rootkits, just because they modify the already loaded hypervisor. So let's focus on what we're going to talk about in this part. So first, we're going to talk about four things. We're going to talk about protecting the Zen hypervisor against this type of attacks, and we're also going to mention some new prevention methods that has been introduced in Zen 3.2, as well as Zen 3.3 that is going to be released this month, I guess. And also we're going to see how those prevention methods actually fail sometimes. And then we're going to talk about Zen integrity checking. We're going to introduce some prototype product that we just started working with Phoenix on. And we're going to talk about challenges with doing that. So let's start with DMA attacks and how to protect against them. So this is the picture of what Rafał did in the previous speech. So we had Zen, which might have been a trusted hypervisor, whatever, and we had a domain zero to which he somehow got, maybe using a bug that he discovered in the previous months or some other people discovered in previous months. Anyway, what he did is he asked one of the devices to set up a DMA transfer to a physical memory that just happens to be occupied by the Zen hypervisor. This way he were able to modify Zen's memory, well, and do various things with that. However, Zen 3.2, and especially Zen 3.3, makes a lot of use of Intel VTD. And on Intel VTD, which is Intel's implementation of IOMMU, those attacks are prevented just because we have additional protection here, VTD, so if there is a malicious transfer set by device, it will be blocked on a VTD. And obviously, each domain is separated, each paravirtualized domain is separated from hypervisor by using a processor ring 3, ring 0 separation, or ring 1, ring 0 separation. On 64-bit, this is all the kernel runs in ring 3, on 32-bit in ring 1. This is the actual code in Zen that sets the protection for the hypervisor and as well also for tboot module. So, Rafał DMA attack will not work on systems that have DMA. And one example of such system is Intel DQ35 motherboard that I was able to buy in computer shop in October. So this is something that really is on the market and we really have that. So this motherboard supports a couple of things and for us the most important thing is the VTD. So let's see how Rafał's attack fails on the VTD hardware. So I'm just showing you that runs in Zen 3.3 context, the direct IO is HVM direct IO is enabled. You also see that VTD has been enabled. Can we have those front lights turned off a little bit? And you see that it just froze here. The system hang. Because VTD prevented the attack, the controller that we programmed, that Rafał's attack programmed, the disk controller, were trying to get this DMA read access on a bus, but nobody were able to answer it because VTD just cut it off. So the system hanged. Okay, so how to get around it? Well, two ways. We have this picture. We are here. We want to get here. But we have two protections. Here we have ring training zero separation, and here we have VTD. So we either, I'm sorry, my balance is too sensitive. So we either need to break ring training zero separation, or we need to break VTD protection. Interestingly, we can get around without breaking none of them. And here we have a couple of slides that describe the attack against Q35 chip, but the attack that allowed us to modify Zen memory using some features on Q35 chipset. However, because Intel still is working on a patch, and the patch should be available after DEF CON, Intel asked us to remove the slides that have some details on the attack, and those slides will be published as soon as Intel is going to publish their patch. But we still are able to show you the demo of the attack, assuming you don't have any high-resolution camera here. So, again, I'll be reading it for you because it's just too small. We're running in context Zen 3.3. VTD is enabled on the system. So the same situation as previously where the system hanged. And now this magic Q35 fan exploit that we're going to post on our website after the patch will be available. And what this exploit does is it modifies one of the hypercall, unused hypercall, do NI hypercall that Alex, that Rafawis uses in his attack, overriding it with jump RID. This is the code we want to load. It's just a print K in the context of Zen hypervisor. It prints all your hypervisor are belong to us. And let's try to load it now. Remember, Zen 3.3 running on VTD hardware. Can we get those lights turned off in the front? Module loaded successfully. Let's look at this XMD mask. So the log from the Zen hypervisor. And here it is. Zen outputted all your hypervisors that belong to us. So our print K did execute in the Zen context. So despite VTD protection, we were able to modify Zen memory here. Can we get this light darker in front? Why not? Can we get it off? Those movies will also be available on our website as soon as the patch will be available. We're going to publish all the demos and all the code. This, by the way, is not limited to Q35 chipsets only. However, it's most important, most interesting for us on Q35 chipsets just because those chipsets have VTD, and in terms of Zen compromises, this is interesting. However, this attack also can be used to bypass SMM protection. So yesterday we had a speech by Sherry Sparks and Sean, where they said that unfortunately SMM rootkits are limited only to systems that are older than 2005. And this is not true. This Q35 is the most recent Intel motherboard, and with this Q35 attack you can still overwrite SMM even though the deadlock bit is set. So whose fault is it? Is it Zen's fault? So maybe Zen shouldn't allow domain zero driver domains to access some chipset registers. Or maybe it should, maybe it's needed for something. Actually, we don't know, frankly. And even if it was needed, it's still, we shouldn't require from Zen to do this kind of filtering because Zen cannot know about all the possible chipsets on the market. So it cannot know that, for example, on Q35, this kind of registers should not be accessed because maybe those could be used to do something like that or not. So maybe it's a chipset's fault. Maybe the chipset should not allow you to do this kind of trick. Maybe chipsets should realize that we try to set up some trick that you will learn this trick after we publish the full version of slides. Maybe the chipset should realize that we are doing some nasty trick. We are abusing some mechanism. Most likely we could do it on a chipset. However, as we learned from Intel guys that we talked to some time ago, for some time about this problem, Intel BIOS specification, which is unfortunately not a public document, apparently this BIOS specification tells that BIOS vendors should lock some additional things, some additional bits besides the lock to avoid this kind of attacks. So it turns out to be the BIOS fault. But obviously on this Intel motherboard was Intel BIOS. So it's in this case, that's why the problem is going to be fixed by Intel. So I've got a better slide for this. Two related attacks somehow. Louis Duflo in 2006 presented an attack that allowed him to bypass OpenBSD secure level mechanism that protects the OpenBSD kernel. He just loaded his code into SMM handler and compromised kernel from there. That was possible because back in 2006, many systems didn't have DLOG bit set properly. Right now, most of the systems have, as Sherry and Sean told us yesterday, so this attack is no longer feasible. And a similar attack by Sunbing 1 year later about exploiting top swap mechanism that allowed him to load some code before BIOS and then compromise the SMM. However, this attack is not interesting in our case because it requires a reboot. So lesson from this is protecting hypervisors and hypervisor memory is difficult.
Okay, so far we have learned that recently Xen takes advantage of a few features of the chipset. And as it turns out, at least recently, Xen Follows has been aggressively trying to apply as many security measures as possible. So let's have a look at one trend they are trying to follow about decomposing the domain zero into a bunch of less privileged entities. Because so far, everything that is privileged, like administration of the hardware, starting of the domains, etc., etc., all these privileged parts are in domain zero. The first thing we can talk about is driver domains, because that's how it works at the moment, right? Domain zero holds the device drivers for each hardware you have, and unprivileged domains talk to the domain zero backend in order to, well, use these resources. So unfortunately, that means if there is a bug in device driver for any hardware used in domain zero, and if it can be compromised, it means that domain zero kernel is compromised. And this is bad. Especially that a lot of folks claim that the quality of the device drivers is significantly lower than the quality of the rest of the code. And you may remember there were issues with bugs in the wireless card drivers a year ago. So you could just remotely compromise a wireless card driver. So the solution to that is a driver domain. So instead of hosting all the drivers within otherwise privileged domain zero, we dedicate some particular unprivileged domain to hold this driver. And the interaction with other domains is the same. Again, other domains contact the backend in this domain. And the benefit is that at this moment, with this setup, if there is a bug in the driver, all that attacker gets is access to the unprivileged domain. And previously, he was able to get full control over the privileged domain zero. Of course, there is one tiny glitch, as I have already mentioned in the previous talk. We really need protection methods to restrict DMA, right? Because otherwise, after the compromise of this driver domain, we could use DMA to further escalate our privileges. This I have already covered. Stub domains, another mechanism. Okay, that's why how currently a HVM machine accesses the resources, the virtualized hardware. It talks to a QEMU process, which again is hosted within domain zero, and that QEMU process is responsible for emulating the hardware. So again, if there is a bug in QEMU, and this HBM domain is able to execute code in the context of QEMU, that's again very bad, because we can execute arbitrary code in domain zero. So solution, again, introduce a special domain whose only purpose is to host QEMU process. Again, the interaction is very similar, but at this time, compromise of QEMU gives only the privilege in the unprivileged stub domain, not the compromise of domain zero. Another improvement made. Okay, so far, when you want to boot a paravirtualized domain, you have to specify what kernel to use, right? And currently it is done with the help of the pygrab process, which runs in domain zero, and it mounts the file system of the PV domain, extracts the kernel, and then boots this kernel. And again, this is not particularly secure because there's a lot of interaction of a privileged process, pygrab in this picture, with untrusted data, the file system metadata and the configuration file stored in the PV domain. And in fact, there was at least two vulnerabilities with pygrab, again, which relied on feeding some malformed data to pygrab. And the solution is move the responsibilities of pygrab to the PV domain. In this setup, it looks very similar, but this time the whole grab or version of the grab process runs within the PV domain. Again, its responsibility is to mount the file system of the PV domain and extract the kernel. But this time it is running confined within the PV domain. And even if it's compromised, attacker gains very little, or I think nothing in this scenario. Because all that he does achieve is, again, privileges within the confined PV domain. And to sum up, there are really a couple of interesting solutions introduced in Xen 3.3 especially.
So before we go a little bit further and show some attacks that cannot be protected by those mechanisms, let's quickly compare Xen against the competition. So I try to compare Xen 3.3 because the mechanisms that Rafał just mentioned, they apply to Xen 3.2 and 3.3. Some of them only to Xen 3.3, like stub domains. And driver domains are present in 3.2 already. So let's compare Xen 3.3 that is going to be released this month with Hyper-V and ESX. So let's look which of them support VTD or IOMMU. So Xen 3.3 supports it, 3.2 as well. Hyper-V, unfortunately, not. And ESX, we don't know. And by the way, I need to make a comment that we spent a lot of time playing with Xen, Invisible Things Lab team. However, we haven't played with Hyper-V, nor we haven't played with ESX. So all the information about Hyper-V I got from Brandon Becker from Microsoft, who is a security guru in virtualization group there. He's sitting just right there. So he was nice enough to answer all my questions about Hyper-V and also agreed to quote him as a source. I also tried to find a lot of all those information to ESX. I failed to do this on the web. That's why you will see a lot of question marks here. I also tried to contact one very well-known VMware engineer, security guy, but unfortunately he didn't answer to my questions. So VTD, this is the status. Hypervisor protected from the admin domain, including DMA attack. Xen 3.3, as you just saw, yes. Hyper-V, no. ESX, we don't know. Driver domains, support for driver domains, meaning support to delegate a device to an unprivileged domain, PCI pass-through, for example. Yes. In Hyper-V, no. Drivers are in the root domain. On ASX, I found a presentation by Audit Horowitz from ConsequeQuest, March 2008, where it was slide number 3. It was a picture that suggested that drivers on ESX are kept in a hypervisor, which, in my opinion, is a very bad design because it makes hypervisor huge and the attack surface very large. And attacks similar to that we're going to show you just in 5 minutes, Rafa will going to talk to you about, are much, probably much more likely in that architecture. IO emulator placement, device virtualization. So where is the QEMU process? So again, Xen 3.3, there is a possibility to put it in an unprivileged domain. These are the subdomains thing that Rafał just discussed. On Xen 3.2, however, it is still running in domain 0, the privileged one, as a root process. So 3.2 would be no here. On Hyper-V, this is an unprivileged process that, however, runs in a privileged domain, in the root domain. You might see that I made it a little bit less green than this thing, because this seems to be potentially a little bit less secure, because potentially this unprivileged process has a larger attack space on the kernel, on the kernel above it, which is the kernel of the root domain, which is Windows 2000 server, rather than the QEMU running in a stub domain, which itself runs something that is called mini OS, that is, well, very minimal. On ESX, we don't know. I would like to stress it. I'm not criticizing ESX right now. All I'm criticizing is the lack of information available to, like, an ordinary person trying to find out more. And I would really appreciate ESX to make those information more public, and I would be happy to put them in the table and put everything green if this is green. Trusted boot support, which means DRTM or SRTM, dynamic root of trust measurement or static root of trust measurement. Both of those technologies require TPM, and well, SRTM is similar to BitLocker, so we have a chain of trust, bias measures, MBR, MBR measures, OS loader, etc. Each of them puts measurement in a TPM, and only if the hashes were correct, TPM will unseal the correct key to decrypt the rest of the system, or DRTM, which requires either Intel TXT technology, which means S-enter instruction, or AMD SK-init instruction, that are very surprising instructions that promise to run a secure and a trusted environment from untrusted one. And Xen 3.2 and 3.3 does have support for that, and this is called T-boot, and T-boot is being developed by Intel guys. One of the guys sits just right there. So very good. T-boot ensures that what we load at boot time is trusted. Hyper-V, no, it doesn't have support at the moment. ESX, we don't know. And looking at this table, you probably think, like, what is the trend? So I talked with Brandon, and he said that Hyper-V next generation will definitely try to implement some of those features. So it seems that this might be a trend that other hypervisors will be following. So it will be really interesting to see the next version of Hyper-V, how it competes with Xen, because it might be really interesting, especially because its code base is much smaller than the Xen hypervisor, which you will see at some next slides. Okay, so does it really work, all those security features? Well, as I said, no doubt, in our opinion, this, what was on Xen, those separate domains, QEMU in unprivileged domain, etc., the support for trusted boot, this is the way to go. No question about it. However, so Xen is well done, but there's always a possibility of overflows in hypervisor. So far, there has not been a single overflow, exploitable overflow in Xen 3 hypervisor. Well, until Rafa look at this and Sarah's got it.
Okay, so as you've already heard, I will talk a little while about the bug I have found a couple of months ago in the Xen's code, and it resides in the code which implements Flask. And what is Flask? Flask is one of the available implementation of XSM, which acronym stands for Xen Security Modules. And it's not very critical at the moment to explain what exactly it's it's supposed to do. From the overview is that it's supposed to allow to provide fine-grained control of the security decisions conducted by XAMPP. So the idea is that whenever, for instance, hypercall, some action is to be allowed or not, some code in a security module is consulted whether to allow it or not. So it works a little bit like SE Linux, and in fact, implementation of XSM is based on Linux security modules. And currently there are two implementations based on this framework. One is S-Hype, done by IBM, and the other is Flask, done by NSA. The important thing is that Flask is not compiled in by default into XAMPP. So in order to save you from heart attack, most of the installation of XAMPP does not contain the vulnerable code. Because you can see in this screenshot that you have explicitly enabled XSM and Flask in the configuration file when you compile XAMPP. So again, the vulnerable code is not found on most installations, yet again, this bug resides in XAMPP's code officially shipped. So we think it's kind of important. Okay, so exactly what kind of bug is it? Hopefully at least guys from the front rows can see it. This little line is copy from user, the destination being the buffer, which is always one page long. But the source of the memory copy is specified by the user. And also the site of the copy is specified by the user, which definitely smells bad. So this one is in the Flask security user function. And there is another precious thing, this time in Flask security label. You can see there is a call to ssconf function, which parses a string. And again, the size, the input to this function, so the buff variable, is under full control of the user. And the output buffers, scon and tcon, their size is also determined by the parameters controlled by the user. So we can control the size of the buffers and we control the input to this function. So that's an old-fashioned 90s buffer overflow. The question is it exploitable? How serious this is? Because both these overflows result in XAMPP's heap being destroyed, overflowed. So I think there are currently not many literature about exploiting XAMPP heap overflows. So I took a look at that. So the first thing, as usual, the buffers are located on heap, on most, I guess, operating systems, are preceded by such a header. Again, in this header, you have this familiar backlink pointer and forward link pointer. And if you have read, for instance, papers on exploiting heap overflows in Windows 2000, you may remember that if we override these pointers, when this metadata is manipulated, we may achieve arbitrary memory overwrite. So I tried that, but unfortunately, it appears that this method of exploitation, that is overwriting these pointers, has a severe disadvantage. Namely, we have to know the address of the root node of the list of the free chunks. It happens when you look at the code that when these pointers are referenced, we enter a loop which we break out of only when we traverse the list of the nodes and when we arrive to the head of this list. So if you override these pointers, which will point somewhere else, and if we don't know the address of the root node of the list, this loop will never end. So the exploitation will result in an infinite loop within the hypervisor's body. So I had to figure out something else. And the basic idea is to override not these pointers, but instead the size field. And the reason why we spend a lot of energy with overwriting the size field is that if you control the size field, we have a great deal of control over the layout of the heap. Because generally, there is very little way in which unprivileged domain can control the heap layout. Basically, even if memory is dynamically allocated in a hypercall, then it's immediately, almost immediately freed when the before hypercall returns. So it's very difficult to manipulate the heap layout. And another thing is that even in non-debug builds, there are some sanity checks, particularly in X-free function. And I'm trying to justify why the pictures I will show are so complicated and difficult to grasp. Okay, so the basic idea is we override the header of the chunk so that we set the size to some in the exploit to the value being 999. And what happens here when we override this size field? This chunk, there is one more thing. Generally, Xen allocates memory on the heap in two ways. When you request a small chunk, smaller than 4Ks, it will try to extract this chunk from the list of the free chunks. And if you request larger memory, for instance, above 4K, it will go directly to the body algorithm, which will give whole pages. So what we will do, we'll overflow the header, which was in a memory acquired from the body algorithm, the whole page, will overwrite with the size, which will look like as though it has come from the free list. So overall, conceptually, we'll corrupt the structures used by the allocator. Okay, so we overwrite the size field. And then we use the second overflow in the second function. But before, we invoke a hypercall which will allocate the struct Xenoprof. It is a structure used by all hypercalls which deal with profiling of the code. And it happens some of these hypercalls are available for unprivileged domain as well. So, after we have override this size field, we know exactly where this Xenoprof structure will be allocated. It will be allocated precisely in the place where the previous buffer was placed. So generally, we have the control of the heap layout at the moment. We know where this track Xenoprof will be located. So with the help of the second buffer overflow, we can very precisely override fields within the struct Xenoprof. And, okay, if there were, for instance, code pointers within the Xenoprof struct, then it would be game over, right? You would just override some code pointer and wait for it being the reference. Unfortunately, there are no code pointers in there, but there are data pointers. Moreover, these data pointers are dereferenced and a null word is being written to the place where they point to. And in a hypercall, we can trigger again from unprivileged domain. So what we'll do, we'll override this Xenoprof structure so that some pointers within it will point to a location within Xen. And later, we will force the reference of this pointer so that a zero word will be written to the location that we control. Yeah, this is the reference of the pointers will happen when we free Xenoprof structure, and the function which is responsible for that is Xenoprof enable VIRCO. And the important thing is it's reachable from unprivileged domain. So to sum up, what we get is we can write zero to an arbitrary location, including location within Xen. And it may not seem very exciting, but if you think for a while, it's sufficient. One of possible methods to use it is that you can do partial overwrite of the pointer, for instance, a code pointer within the hypercall table. And as a result, the hypercall table will contain a pointer, again, whose lowest bytes will be zero, so it will point to the user mode address. And then, if we execute the respective hypercall, the execution will arrive at the user mode pages, which we obviously control. So again, it's a little bit complicated, but the general idea is that it's possible to exploit that. And again, the demo of the exploit I will show is some more proof of concept, right? It can be further improved to, for instance, not to require any fixed offsets. Okay, so what do we got here? Okay. So here we have two SSH connections. The first one is to domain zero. And as you can see, an unprivileged domain is already running. So let's have a look at the SSH connection to this unprivileged domain. This is the part of the source code of the exploit. What we'll try to do again is to execute this function with ring zero privileges. And again, it retrieves the value of the CS register and the identifier of the current domain. And it's if the exploit succeeds, appropriate message will be written to the Xen log. So we execute the exploit. It takes a while. The crucial point is hijacking of the free list via Flask user buffer overflow. And if we go back to the Xen log, you can see it with Xen mess. And what we got there? Some message about unsuccessful Xenoprof operation, but again, we are running with ring zero privileges, even from an unprivileged domain, which basically means that all your hypervisor are belong to us. The bug has been patched 2 weeks ago, right? You can see the commit log. And apparently, it was labeled as argument handling bug, XML Flask. I think it deserves some more appropriate description.
So, welcome to the era of Xen heap overflows and exploits. I want to stress one thing here. So even this was a demo of DOM U to hypervisor escape. Again, just remind you, the Flask, the NSA, the Xen security module is not compiled in by default. So unless you use Xen with this feature turned on, this will not work. So just to make sure, this is not something you use to own the planet. So can we get rid of all the bugs in a hypervisor? So I always wanted to put some nice charts in my slides, and that's why I have this slide that shows how the number of lines of C code in Xen changes over versions. Here is Xen 3.04, here is Xen 3.14. So the first one has 240,000 lines of C code, and well, an assembler code. And Xen 3.14 had some 280 maybe. And right now, Xen 3.2.1, which is the latest stable version we have, and Xen 3.3 unstable, they almost have the same number, around 300,000. So it's a bit disturbing because Xen seems to be growing over time instead of shrinking. As a comparison, here's Xen 3.3 versus Hyper-V. The number of lines of code in Xen Hyper-V I got from just quoted Brandon Baker. Hyper-V has only 100,000 lines of code in hypervisor. This looks very good. However, please remember that Hyper-V does not use any, well, it uses, but it doesn't use, it doesn't protect the hypervisor from its root domain, for example, against DMA attacks, which means that right now to this code base, the root domain code should also be added, because right now it's getting into root domain means you get into the hypervisor on Hyper-V. However, thinking about future Hyper-V versions that most likely will try to implement, well, for sure will have VTD support and some other features that were in this table that compare them, that will have those features that Xen have, that would really be interesting to see this how Hyper-V will compete with Xen, because right now it's so small, if they manage to keep it so simple, that might really start being the most secure hypervisor then. So lessons learned, hypervisors are not really special piece of code. They still can be compromised. just like normal operating system kernels can be compromised. And computer systems are complex, which means we cannot only rely on prevention. Prevention, not enough. This is the moral from this chapter. So let's talk about ensuring hypervisor integrity. So integrity scanning. Integrity scanning can be, well, we could either try to do it in a straightforward way, in which case we just ensure the hypervisor's code and data correctness. Well, this is tricky. And there's another way to do that that I want to focus on today, and it means ensure there is no untrusted code in a hypervisor. So this is the classic way. We have hypervisor and we have all those data. So this is problematic because even the code is easy to verify, especially when we have digital signatures, but data is not. We can modify all those function pointers and nobody knows where they are. So even if we have a reliable scanner somewhere, we don't know how to make it to check everything because nobody really knows what to check. So the other approach would be to make sure that the only pages that are in hypervisor that are executable are pages that we are aware of. So the reasoning in the first look is that if we don't allow untrusted executable pages, there will be no space for rootkit or backdoor code, even though some function pointers might have been subverted. Not really, but this is the first look at this method. So if we have executable page, which is untrusted, which means which we don't know about, which doesn't have digital signature maybe, then we don't like the situation. So ensuring there's no untrusted code in hypervisor, on a very high level, this could be done this way. We just read hypervisor CR3. I still haven't said where is the detector. Just wait a second. Let's say detector is somewhere in a safe place. So we read the hypervisor CR3. Then we parse the page tables and the hypervisor's page tables. And we find all those pages that are executable and supervisor pages marked in their PTEs. And then we verify hashes of those code pages that they remain the same as they were at, let's say, initialization phase. And of course, we ensure the correctness of initialization phase, or that we make sure it's trusted then using, for example, trusted boot for them. And also, we ensure some system-wide registers like CR4, CR0 has not been modified. However, there are some catches. First, to make it work, some really obvious and trivial requirements are needed for the hypervisor. So first of all, it must strictly apply the non-executable bit, or in case of Intel, that would be XD bit, execute disable bit. So this means that only code, in normal situation, only code pages are not non-exit. Everything else should be marked with an X. Stack, heap, data, everything. Right now, this is not the case for Zen. No self-modified code in the hypervisor. Quite obvious requirement. Again, right now, this is not quite the case for Zen because there is one place that we know about. It is in the IO in-out handler. In-out handler for PV domains in one place builds a trampoline, and this trampoline gets code copied from user mode. Really crazy stuff, but most likely they can get rid of this. And also, hypervisor's code should not be pageable. Again, this is not, I think it applies to them, actually. Well, like, hypervisor should be small, so why to make a code there pageable? And so we believe that hypervisor can meet those requirements with just a few cosmetic workarounds. Interestingly, Hyper-V apparently already meets all those requirements. But there are traps here.
Okay, so the basic idea is that we look at the code which is within the hypervisor and see if it's known trusted code. The first problem is that the rootkit may keep its code not in the pages marked as supervisor, but in user mode pages. And CPU will happily execute them from ring zero as well. So the idea is that, well, for instance, you corrupt some pointer within the hypervisor so that they point to the data stored within the domains. And this will work, right? Whenever this code pointer will be dereferenced, the execution will arrive at the code introduced by the backdoor. Which is a bad thing. Maybe it's not very straightforward because you have to ensure that appropriate code is in every domain, but it's doable. There is a very nice solution which we would like to have. Namely, there is no reason why CPU should execute code from user mode pages when it runs in hypervisor context, right? Why a code running with ring zero privileges would like to execute code stored in user mode pages, which are under control of the user land by the guest by default. So we may name it NX plus or XD plus. We try to talk with Intel guys whether it's feasible to implement it, and we'll see how it goes. And this would be a very powerful measure, not only for this particular project, but if you follow, for instance, the developments on security disk, almost every exploit which exploits some vulnerability within, for instance, Linux kernel, works this way. It corrupts some structures within the kernel and then divert the execution into the code which is conveniently stored in the user land, which we can conveniently prepare. So that solution would make that sort of exploitation impossible, which would be very, very nice. Okay, another problem. Even if you make sure there is no untrusted code in the hypervisor context, does it mean we can ensure that all the action, all the execution will conduct as we expect? And the problem is no, and again, if you heard about returning to libc exploits, which basically do not execute any code provided by the attacker. Instead, they jump through the locations in a legal code so that a desired action is taken. So it's possible, it's doable to conduct a similar attack in this case. And of course, be aware that these sort of attacks are applicable not only on x86 32-bit platforms, it works on the 64 bits as well. For instance, a similar example that if we corrupt an IDT entry, you may point the pointer to some place in Xen's code which does something useful. Not necessarily jump RDI, but again, accesses other registers, etc., etc. I won't go into the details. And then the effect is it creates a local backdoor. Anyone who can execute this software interrupt can force the execution, maybe not of arbitrary code, but of a code which will do the desired action, which is very, very unpleasant. The good thing is that such type of exploit is less popular. First of all, an attacker needs to have quite a lot of control about the execution environment. Either it has to corrupt all the stack, or at least it should have control upon most of the registers, so it can conduct execution as she sees fit. So the benefit is that we have so far identified only a few structures, functions, pointers, etc., that could be used to conduct such sort of attack. And this is good. We don't need to, well, verify every data pointer, just a few function pointers. And examples are, for instance, IDT entries, hypercore table, maybe exception table. So the lesson is that in addition to checking that all the executable code pages are known and trusted, we should also have additional function which will do some sort of sanity checks over the rest of the well, potentially exploitable location.
Just want to stress, this function doesn't need to be in HyperGuard. This is something built into Xen, for example. So HyperGuard is not, doesn't need to be aware of those details. This is what we require from the vendor, Xen vendor, to come up with this function, which should really be very simple. Notice that on the previous slides were few structures.
Okay, and one more thing. We check integrity at during the scan, right? Okay, so we made sure that last time we have conducted the scan, everything was in order. But what happens between the scans? So you have some diagram. Okay, we checked the integrity of the code in these intervals, and it was okay. But does it mean that we are sure that between these scans, nothing bad happens? And again, it's not a straightforward question, and we have we'll spend quite a few of hours discussing all the possible exploitation methods and the ways to prevent it. So we won't dwell about that to the full details. We need to come up with some reliable solutions. So the strategy is still being formulated.
So introducing HyperGuard that I mentioned already and Rafael as well. So HyperGuard is a project that just recently we have started with doing with Phoenix Technologies, and the idea is to put it to the integrity scanner into SMM Handler. So from SMM Handler we scan there are no untrusted code in Hypervisor. Automatically, because this sanity function is part of Xen, and we scan that all the executable pages are trusted, we scan the we solve the trap number. I think. Why in SMM? So these are the places where you could place the integrity scanner for a hypervisor. SMM handler, PCI device are in a chipset, NordBridge, for example. Just like we heard yesterday from Yuri, where he showed the example of a chipset-based, NordBridge-based detector. So SMM handler is a tamper-proof, meaning can it be subverted from ring zero or from hypervisor? Well, theoretically SMM should be, as you just show with our Q35 exploit. This is not really true in practice, because this is what our exploit could be used for. So it should be, but it's not really. However, it has one very important feature. It is access to CPU state. It can read all the registers that are currently being used by the processor. And also it has reliable access to DRAM. PCI device, well, for sure it can be made tamper-proof. However, it doesn't have access to CPU state, and it doesn't have a reliable access to DRAM. How come? Because of VTD, for example. Chipset, NordBridge-based. Tamper-proof, well, almost for sure, right? Well, unless you start letting the antivirus engines into your NordBridge, which would be a very bad idea, and I really hope Yuri will never allow for that. However, it doesn't have access to CPU state, and it was stressed yesterday during the Yuri speech. But yes, it has access to reliable access to DRAM, which is good. So how about combine those two approaches? How about use the URI's chipset-based integrity scanner to ensure the integrity of SMM handler, which we need because we need access to CPU state. So this is the reference to his talk. If you haven't seen it, it would be good to download those slides. And this is the picture, how it would look like. So we had this HyperGuard here. We have URI's scanner here, which ensures integrity of this scanner. Additionally, it would be a very good idea to delegate some potentially time-consuming tasks like calculating the hashes back to the scanner. So we only implement simple logic here, the logic that requires access to CPU state. Everything else we delegate to URI. If we combine those two, we get the fourth table in this, the fourth column in this table, which has everything green, yes, which looks very nice. But just remember that the deeper we are, the simpler we should be. So again, that the idea of letting antivirus engines in this Nord Bridge is a horrible idea to me. However, the idea of doing something as simple as I just presented on the slide, ensuring integrity of SMM handler, it's a probably great idea. HyperGuard might also be used, because you just noticed that we start, well, HyperGuard right now, the goal is to use it to ensure the integrity of hypervisor, of Xen hypervisor, and of course, the Phoenix HyperCore hypervisor, most likely could be easily used to ensure the integrity of Hyper-V hypervisor. We would love to also work with VMware if they wanted to make it to work for V hypervisor. We start from hypervisor, which is natural because hypervisors are much, well, are new, are much simpler than normal OS kernels. And obviously, the compromise of a hypervisor is much more, is very fatal. So this is really something that we should really put some effort into making sure that we can reliably ensure integrity. We lost this chance with, we don't have any good ways to do that for normal kernels, like Windows kernel, Linux kernel. But theoretically, in the future, if vendors only wanted to modify their kernels and all the drivers to meet those three requirements, that could be used as well. Slides for this talk will be available at this address. It will be after, I will post the PDFs there after the third speech as soon as I get a chance to get to my room, which might be in the evening. And demos and code will be published after we have patch from Intel, then you will have all the code and demos together. Thanks to Brandon Baker from Microsoft for providing information about Hyper-V and discussions. Thank you very much.